This is Acacia aphylla. Aphylla literally means leafless. It's a really wacky looking plant. Masses of these blue stems. It's twiggy and it's sticky. It has architecture. It has form and structure. It's a truly bizarre looking plant.
This strangely architectural acacia is one of the thousands of plants in a garden that in October was declared the Landscape of the Year by the World Architecture Festival Awards. This is Off Track here on RN. I'm Joel Werner, but really, I should be Amanda Smith. Amanda has completely lost her voice, but not before recording this Off Track earlier in the week at the World's Landscape of the Year.
This is Cranbourne in Victoria, about 45 k's southeast of Melbourne, and I'm standing where a sand quarry used to be. It's now the site of the world's largest collection of Australian flora. It's the Australian Garden, part of the Royal Botanic Gardens Cranbourne, and John Arnott is the manager of horticulture here. G'day, John.
G'day.
Another dedicated Australian flora garden that I've been to is Olive Pink's garden in Alice Springs, where the plants really grow wild. This couldn't be more different in a lot of ways. This is not just designed, it's sculpted, it's choreographed.
Look, I love Olive Pink Garden, and I love the diversity of botanic gardens in Australia. And, you know, every botanic garden is unique in its own way. Can you say that something's particularly unique? There is no. There is no other garden which is like the Australian garden. It's landscape architecture, art, horticulture, ecology, social sciences, you know, almost in equal parts. But what really drives the Australian garden is the landscape design. So we're not trying to emulate or make something look like the bush, but we're trying to capture the essence of the Australian landscape. You know, so we're standing here in front of the Red Sand Garden, and the Red Sand Garden, it's a big, vast, largely empty space where vegetation is really sparse. What's implied in this landscape is this is the Red Sand Country of inland Australia, where water's mostly absent, vegetation is really sparse, and it's a big sky landscape. It's non-naturalistic. You wouldn't look at any area of Central Australia and see this structure. But the essence of the landscape is sort of embedded in the design. We've got a line of annual flowering plants.
Like a sort of diameter across this huge circle.
2 metres wide and, what's that, about 85 metres long. And it's a wildflower meadow, but it's a wildflower meadow which is not across a plain. It's lineal.
A big band of it.
It's a band.
And it's bright green and yellow across this red sand.
Yeah, that's right. And what that's trying to evoke is that the kind of the wildflower response that you get in inland Australia after big rain events. So many of Australian plants are ephemeral. So after rain events, they'll germinate, they'll grow, they'll produce masses of seed, they'll put on a floral display for a short period of time, they'll dump a whole heap of seed back into the ground and wait for the next rain event. So what this is trying to capture in a display sense is the ephemeral nature of wildflowers in the Australian bush. But it's done in a very contrived way. It's a very different way of presenting plants.
In a very, sort of contemporary, arty way. I mean, if I were to make an analogy between here and the Royal Botanic Gardens in Melbourne, for example, which are very traditional, lush, verdant.
Garden-esque.
Yes, yes. I'd say that was, if that was an art gallery, it would be full of old masters, European masters.
Yep.
And this is really contemporary Australian art that's bright, that's geometric, some sort of abstract and funky.
Yeah, and if you were to sort of personify the two landscapes, you would come up with two very different people, the same organisation, but with two very, very different faces. It's interesting. The idea for an Australian plant garden actually goes back to, the mid-40s. You know, the horticultural managers of the day in the 1940s were discussing the fact that there were limited opportunities to cultivate Australian plants at the Royal Botanic Gardens, Melbourne, because the microclimates there, they just weren't suited to a whole range of inland plants, semi-arid plants, plants from Western Australia. So there were a number of chapters of the Australian flora that just couldn't be told at the Royal Botanic Gardens, Melbourne. So it was a long gestation from 1945 to completing the project in 2012, 2013.
Well, most public gardens in Australia and most of our own domestic gardens are still dominated by exotic plants, I suppose. So many of us are still not really accustomed to thinking of Australian flora as what we want in a garden. You know, it's not pretty enough. It's not interesting enough. Too scrubby. I can only imagine your mission here is to say, not true.
That is completely our agenda, is to say not true. So that's embedded into the design brief for this garden, to explore opportunities to flick that switch and to try and sort of debunk that myth that Australian plants aren't glamorous, kind of inferior as garden plants. You know, there's an Australian plant for every application in a garden. Some of the great cottage, you know, we think of cottage gardens as being, you know, gardens which are full of
foxgloves.
Foxgloves. Well, we have the equivalent of foxgloves. A really important aspect of this garden is to give people those ideas and directions. We're testing that. There's been a study which is looking at the effectiveness of the Australian garden in influencing the nature of the horticulture which is happening in the Cranbourne region.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that.
Okay. Yeah. So it's a study which has almost been completed to see if there's a thread of Australian garden plants being expressed out there in our community. And there is a thread. The full extent of that is still to be determined because we haven't crunched the numbers as yet. But yeah, so I mean, that would be a really nice measure of how effective we are as an organisation, is how much influence we're having.
And if anyone wants to recreate this red sand garden in their backyard.
Look, people are doing it. People are actually doing it. We get lots of phone calls saying, where did you get the red sand? We'd like to do this in miniature in our garden.
Now, you've mentioned that this Australian garden was completed a year ago. I suppose it's always going to be a work in progress. But I mentioned that it used to be a sand quarry. And I guess there was probably very little growing here and the soil wouldn't have been all that good. What have you done to reclaim it?
It certainly was a quarry, and billions of cubic metres of sand were stripped off this site. Most of the mortar that constructed Melbourne was made of sand that came off this site. So they quarried down to a point where they hit what's called fatty sands, or sands that have got a bit of clay fraction in them. So we're gardening in pure sub surface sands.
And have you brought in soil?
No, so we're gardening with the site sands, but ameliorating that site sand with organic matter. We're doing that through a combination of 8% compost and 8% brown coal. So here's a really positive application for brown coal. The reason that this site has been retained as a conservation zone and as an area of really high biodiversity value, I mean, that's the other thing to mention about the site, is it's a display garden that sits in 340 hectares of really high quality indigenous vegetation. And the sand was just so lifeless, it wouldn't support a crop of pasture grasses. So it was kind of left as almost wasteland for many, many years.
All right, now let's take in some of the themed gardens here at the Australian Garden with head horticulturalist John Arnott. Can we do some time travel, John, to the... Let's go to the future garden.
Let's go to the future garden, shall we?
Yeah, that quarry noise is not going to go away.
So there is still a quarry around here somewhere?
It's a stone quarry.
And also, there's a lot of suburban development around here too.
Exactly right. I mean, it's very much an island of biodiversity in a sea of urban growth.
So we've arrived in the future, John.
Well, this is the future garden. All of the plants in this garden have been manipulated by the hand of man, so they're not things that you would go out into the wild and see. So they've been somehow hybridised or selected. It's really...
Or bioengineered?
Not quite bioengineered. So there's no GM plants in here per se, but there's certainly things that have been bred. For centuries, people have been manipulating plants. We're a little bit slow on the uptake to do that with Australian plants, but we're sort of doing it now with a fair bit of gusto. People really like this garden because, you know, there's 8 or 9 raised beds in here, all about 10 metres by about 5 metres across. And they're raised with it's a geotextile sausage around the base, which is the thing which is acting as the sort of the garden edging. This is really overtly about Australian plants are glamorous, spectacular, beautiful. So, for example, you know, we're looking at kangaroo paws. They're a Western Australian native plant, and up until quite recently, a number of them have been pretty exacting in their requirements horticulturally and culturally in gardens, you know, away from Western Australia. So, you know, this is the product of looking at the desirable characteristics of plants and actually breeding them in. And that's typical of the plants in the future garden, but the kangaroo paw is a really nice example of that. So these things are resilient, robust, long-lived plants.
And spectacular deep red.
Beautiful colours. You know, we've got the reds, yellows, we've got some green kangaroo paws over here. So I think that's the take-home message here, is that there are Australian plants that have been manipulated, that we're making some selections of things for desirable characteristics, and that they make cracking garden plants.
I'm now with the Chief Botanist and Acting Director at the Australian Garden, David Cantrell. And David, you're taking me time travelling back to when Australia was part of a much larger continent. What's this garden?
So we're sitting here in the Gondwana Garden, a garden that tells the story of Australian plants in deep time, geological time.
So how long ago are we referencing here?
Well, the garden really goes back to the Cretaceous, so back about 100 million years when flowering plants first appeared on the Earth. The Gondwana Garden sits at the end of the Eucalypt Walk, and that provides some context for it because, of course, the Australian flora came out of the rainforest. In the Eocene, we had rainforest. So the Eocene's a period about 54 million years ago. We had rainforest plants growing in Tasmania, and Australia was very different. And as the continent moved north, became warmer and dried, the characteristic Australian plants came out of that rainforest and evolved from those rainforest ancestors. So the Gondwana Garden will hopefully be able to communicate that story to the public as they walk through it.
Now, your special subject is ancient plants from this period, David, isn't it? So the Gondwana Garden, I guess, is close to your heart.
Yeah, the Gondwana Garden's very close to my heart. I'm a paleobotanist and I've studied fossil floras all across the Southern Hemisphere, from Antarctica through to Africa, New Zealand, Australia, and a little bit in South America. So this garden's very special to me in that respect.
So this is a sort of a contemporary reinterpretation of an ancient rainforest.
Well, in time it'll be a contemporary interpretation of rainforest. Because the garden's so new, we really have to establish a canopy of overstory plants first. And once that canopy's established, we'll be able to put a lot more interesting things in that really tell the rainforest story.
Yes, I mean, that's the thing. This is a very new garden, isn't it? It's going to change a lot over time.
Yes, to establish a decent canopy we're probably talking 15-20 years. Good things take time, and the Gondwana Garden's one of those. Here, let's wander down this way a little bit and then we can have a look and see what we've got down here. This part of the garden's got a couple of interesting things in it. The lineages that they belong to go back to that period. It's got representatives of the Proteaceae family. Proteaceae is a big Southern Hemisphere family, very characteristic of the Cretaceous period about 80 million years ago, all the way through to the Eocene. It also has a stand of Willemia.
And the Woolamai pine, of course, was famously discovered in the 1990s, was it? It was the sort of dinosaur plant, a fossil plant.
Yeah, I think Woolamai pine's one of those plants. It's a little bit iconic, discovered so close to a major capital city and completely unknown to science.
Tell us about the Antarctic beach, David, which isn't growing here just at the moment, but will be.
Yeah, so in time we'll get Antarctic beach established here. This group's today found in places like New Caledonia, New Guinea, Australia, New Zealand and South America. And these are another illustration of how the continents were connected in the past.
How come these ones have got socks on them? Oh, they're seeding and we've just a little bit worried how they might behave, okay. Just the kind of species they are. Yep. It's probably better to cover them just so it doesn't fly off into the gardens.
Okay. Another one of the special gardens that form part of the Australian Garden is the Research Garden. Meg Hurst has a research project going on here. Now, Meg, before we talk about your particular project, I'm interested that here research is brought out and put on display.
What's happening here is we're doing research that's outside of the laboratory, it's outside of the greenhouse, and we're really trying to embrace it so people can walk around the plots and then they can ask questions about what's going on, and it's really trying to bring the role of plant science to the fore.
All right, so your project is with native daisies, yeah? What's the problem you're looking at? What are you wanting to find out?
I'm looking at, first of all, the taxonomy. Look, Brachyscoma are an amazing group. They're about 80-odd species. You'll find them across Australia. Brachisco multifida that everybody knows. It's in most gardens. It's very, very common. Lovely, almost fern-like leaves with beautiful purple little flowers that sit above. And in fact, if you just look over there, you'll see them just flowering.
Yeah, they're the little mauvey pinky daisies.
Yeah, we've also been harvesting Brachyscome tagellii, which is an alpine species. It's found in moist peat bogs in the alpine habitat. And then we've got Brachyscome radicula, which is found on rocky outcrops. So you'll find them across a myriad of conditions. So they're a great group to work on if you want to look at how species might respond to a different climatic conditions, and then to ask questions on their physiology. And that's what we're doing here at Cranbourne.
Okay, so how are you going about that? What are you doing to understand their physiology here?
So we've got about 30 species currently in one of these raised plots.
So I should say we're surrounded by how many raised plots here?
There's 14 raised plots, and I've managed to occupy 11 at the moment. So it's pretty much Brachyscome City here. We've put heating cables through some of the plots, and so what we're doing is we're raising the soil temperature around the root zone of some of the plots and measuring how plants respond to that.
So that raising temperature, is that in relation to climate change?
Well, species are forecast to exhibit large shifts in their abundance and their geographic range. So the questions that we're asking will directly link to climate change, yes. At the moment, we're just harvesting one experiment, so we've just been measuring 4,000 plants. And we were looking at a heat stress there and measuring height and longest leaf and flowering time over a year. And so what we've found, which is really interesting, because we've had different populations of widespread species and some different populations of quite rare or quite restricted species, and what we're finding is that populations respond differently. And although that's probably no surprise to a lot of people, what it does also tell us is that genetic diversity is really important. And so preserving populations and looking at populations for their genetic diversity is really one way of tackling how species may cope over time with climate change.
The truth is, Meg, it's really windy here.
Oh, I know. And look, every time you're doing measurements, you'll put your head down and then your hat will just go blowing off and flying off over there where the eucalypts are. See you later.
Thank you. Cheerio.
You're listening to Off Track here on RN. I'm Joel Werner, and today we're at the Australian Garden in Cranbourne in Victoria. This is a massive display of Australian flora like no other. You can see espaliered eucalyptus here. Actually, if you like the idea of espaliering your own eucalyptus, there's a photo on the Off Track website. Why don't you check it out? Amanda Smith is at the Australian Garden, back now with the Manager of Horticulture, John Arnott.
So, John, this is another garden that I wanted you to show me, and it's the Weird and Wonderful Garden. I'm intrigued.
The Weird and Wonderful Garden, it's looking at Australian plants that are exhibiting really interesting adaptations or interesting shapes, forms, sizes, or interesting biologies.
Such as?
We're right in front of the Queensland bottle trees. Now, Queensland bottle trees are...
They're weird.
They're a weird-looking thing. I mean, they're kind of Boab-esque. They're not Boabs, but they kind of have that general appearance of these big swollen trunks. And this is a true succulent. So few of the Australian flora are actually succulent. You think about the deserts of South America, and it's almost 100% cacti and succulent plants. Nearly 20% of the South African flora is succulent. Just a tick over 3% of the Australian flora is succulent. So our flora adapted to aridity in a very, very different way. So, you know, these bottle trees, big swollen trunks storing water in the stems, they're the exception to the rule in terms of adaptation to arid conditions.
There's also, now we can hear the rock crusher from the quarry behind us, and we are actually in this garden surrounded by huge amounts of rocks, big rocks sticking up.
That's right, it's Castlemaine slate, and they're huge, 2 and 3 metres out of the ground, and they're vaulted at 10 degrees off perpendicular.
So again, it's kind of artistic.
Absolutely, this is our version of an alpine garden or a rockery garden. But it's an interesting twist, and it's full of different environmental niches. These big vaulted rocks, one side's facing due north and the other side of the rock is facing due south. On the north faces, they'll be some of the hottest areas in the Australian garden. On the south face of the rocks, very much cooler, very much moister. So we've got desert dwellers on one side of the rock and things from Tasmania and high altitude, high rainfall, cool climate areas on the south side of the rocks. So it's not a geographic collection or an ecological collection. It's microclimates in the weird and wonderful garden. This is a real plant studier's garden.
My name's Terry Coates and I'm an ecologist here at the Royal Botanic Gardens. So this is the outside fence. This is the barrier between the outside and the inside. So the things that live outside in the bushland areas like koalas and wallabies and wombats and snakes and lizards and all those sorts of things are meant to stay out there, and all the plants are meant to stay in here. It's a big issue for us that the plants want to get out and the animals that maybe we don't want in there want to get in. So there's a constant tension between the people who do the horticulture and the people who do the conservation.
So we're stepping outside of the 16 hectares that comprises the Australian garden that's all very cultivated and designed into the rest of this site that totals 363 hectares, moving from, yes, as I said, highly formalised gardening to bushland.
The worthless scrub, as some people call it. This is a large fragment of remnant vegetation which still contains the majority of the biodiversity it would have had when Melbourne was first settled, and, well, our job really is to try and make it stay so. At the moment, we've got a lot of swamp wallabies on site. They're also trying to get into the Australian garden, and they're not as happy about them jumping on top of their shrubs and breaking them as we are.
Ruining the art.
Yeah, so there's a bit of that discussion around about what do we do when a wallaby makes its way into the Australian garden and then starts sitting on all their shrubs.
But you're happy to have them out in your bit.
Oh, well, they're part of the system, but we have to strike that balance with not enough and too many of them.
Like being swamped by swamp wallabies.
Swamped by swamp wallabies. And they don't stay in the swamps, that's the problem. So, but they're a beautiful animal, like a really attractive animal, and I really like seeing them around, but you do have to temper that with the thought that they do eat a lot of stuff.
So we're well and truly off the beaten track now. It does feel like we're way out in the bush, but of course you can still hear the sound of the rock quarry, and civilization is not very far away at all. This is just a remnant patch, really.
Yeah, and, you know, I live in a suburban house. I just drive out of here at night time. We shut the gates and we all drive home through suburbia, and then we come back the next day and unlock the gates and come on site, and then all this magic's happened.
Well, one of the things you're doing here is a recovery project for the southern brown bandicoot. Tell us about the southern brown bandicoot.
They look like a sort of a big rat in a way. Some people confuse them with rats, but they've got a short tail, a long pointy nose. Often you come across them on tracks or around through the gardens, and they've just got their head down a hole, digging up things that they want to eat, and all you can see is their bum sticking out of the hole. I always say they're like teenagers. They get up at about 10 in the morning and go to bed about 10 in the evening. And they're just a really sweet little animal.
But they are endangered.
Yes, so right across Australia. They were widespread from South Australia right up past Sydney, so all around that coastline. But their populations have really declined. So they're in just a few sites now. And it's our sort of conscientious approach to trying to control the threats to the population, which have brought us some pretty good rewards. So we've had a 10-year or so program in fox control on the site, and so we've managed to now maintain that fox population at a pretty low level for a long period of time. We've had a big bounce in the bandicoot population.
So tell me, Terry, why is the southern brown bandicoot worth saving? Does it matter?
Well, I think it probably does. It's a great little beast, and it really does a lot of work and provides all these services to this sort of habitat. You know, the little pits that they dig create these little microclimates where seeds can germinate and you get seedlings developing and surviving. And they also spread a lot of these fungal spores. They eat a lot of fungi, and they spread the spores around in their feces, and then that allows, you know, the inoculation of other plants and all that sort of stuff. So they're probably a crucial little role in the system. And I think when we lose all those linkages in ecosystems, then we start to get the system declining. Now, people might say, hey, does biodiversity matter? Well, this site here is like a little sort of time machine that tells us what Melbourne was like 200 or 300 years ago.
The ecologist for the remnant bushland of the Royal Botanic Gardens, Cranbourne, Victoria, Terry Coates. And in the Australian garden that sits within the site, Amanda Smith was also speaking with John Arnott, the manager of horticulture, Meg Hurst, who's running the Native Daisy Project in the research garden there, and chief botanist and acting director of the Australian garden, David Cantrell. I'm Joel Werner, and I'll be back next week with the best of Off Track over RN Summer. And something to look forward to in the new year is an ABC-BBC co-production I've been working on, where Off Track looks at the state of our oceans. So make sure you tune into that. But until then, bye for now.